This is Jonathan Booth, and this is tape number 2, recounting early days of Signal Hill, California. In addition to the out-of-control oil fires in the early and middle 1920s, Signal Hill also had its share of disastrous refinery fires. One of the very first of these refinery fires was in the early part of the 1930s, when the Richfield Oil Company refinery on the southwest slope of Signal Hill caught fire and burned for many, many days with a huge column of black smoke marking where the fire was. I remember at that time I was in the San Pedro area on business for a number of days, and every so often from that place in San Pedro where I was conducting my business, I would look out of the window towards Signal Hill many, many miles in the distance, and I could see the plume of black smoke coming up from the Richfield Oil Company refinery fire. The most awesome disaster ever to strike the Signal Hill area started on a sunny Thursday morning, May 22, 1958. That was the Hancock Oil Company refinery fire. It was the greatest refinery fire in the United States and the largest fire of any kind west of the Mississippi River. I was working for Hancock at that time and had left my car in the parking lot and gone with a fellow worker into the city of Los Angeles where I was to conduct some business. Along about 12 o'clock, while I was in Los Angeles at the Procter Gamble office building, I looked at my watch and said to my friend, I had better call the refinery and tell them that we're on our way back. So I asked the girl at the switchboard at Procter & Gamble if we could use her telephone. She said yes, but for some inexplicable reason, that is inexplicable at the moment, I was unable to get through to the refinery. So more or less joking, I turned to my friend and said, well, I guess the refinery's finally caught fire. So laughing, we made our way to the elevator and went down to the lobby of the building where I again tried to call the refinery with no success. So we shrugged our shoulders and went out onto the street. As we walked towards our parked car, I saw this ominous pall of black smoke stretching entirely across the horizon from south, east, to far along over Orange County. It seemed to be coming from the vicinity of Long Beach, and I turned to my friend, and my face was probably white because we stared at each other, and I know his face was white, and I said, the refinery is on fire. So we ran to the car and jumped in. And as we started off, I switched on the radio, which was tuned to one of the Long Beach stations, because of course we lived in Long Beach, and most of the time our radio was tuned to a Long Beach station. Consequently, the first thing I heard was an excited voice of an announcer saying, "There goes another tank. We are going to have to move the microphones back. Everybody, get out of the way. It looks like the Hancock Oil Company refinery is going to be a total loss. It looks like nothing whatsoever can save it." Well, we hurried from Los Angeles to Long Beach, and with fear and foreboding in our hearts, it was very difficult to get even near the refinery. I couldn't rescue my car from it, and there was nothing to do but for me to go home, which I did. That evening, along about 8 o'clock, some of us piled into one of our other cars and drove up to the north slope of Signal Hill, where we parked with thousands of other people and watched the whole refinery of the Hancock Oil Company consume itself. As we watched, a 20,000-barrel gasoline tank exploded, and it was an indescribable explosion. An immense column of fire shot into the air with a roar that almost cracked our eardrums. It looked like a hole had opened up and hell was pouring forth. It was a terrible, terrible disaster. The next day I went into my office with the flames still roaring. I was helped in by firemen. I had to rescue some very important papers and retrieve some contracts that were in the process of being consummated. And as I was working frantically to get papers out of a file cabinet, with the fire roaring only 100 yards away and firemen shouting, streams of water being poured onto the fire, sirens wailing in the distance, the phone rang. The reason the phone rang was because an emergency line had been rigged up, and somehow or other, this made it possible for outsiders to get through. Well, not knowing who was on the other end of the line and thinking it could be some sort of an emergency being flashed, I picked up the telephone and said, Hancock Oil Company. And a woman's voice on the other end of the line said, somewhat aggrievedly, I want to know what you people are going to do about my laundry out on the line. It's all ruined. There's oil all over, and I'm going to have that laundry replaced. What are you going to do about it? I said, madam, we're fighting a fire here at the present time that's going to burn our entire refinery down, but I assure you, after the fire is put out, we will be happy to settle whatever claim through our insurance company that you may have against us. The refinery was virtually a total loss. About the only thing that was saved was the thermal catalytic cracker unit, which was later dismantled and sent to the Signal Oil and Gas refinery at Bakersfield. What had caused the fire was that a large fuel oil tank had somehow received some water into it, and with the temperature of the oil in the tank at 240 degrees Fahrenheit, a boil over resulted when the water struck the oil. This caused what we would term an emulsion, and the oil foamed over the protective dike and down into the refinery's processing area. And this oil froth ignited as it went under the boilers, and in an instant the entire refinery was aflame and roaring out of control. The fire burned for days and showered homes all around the area with oil partially burned. Over 9,000 lawsuits were filed against the company, and as a result of this fire, largely as a result of this fire, the Hancock Oil Company ceased to exist as an operating entity and was absorbed into Signal Oil and Gas Company. When my mother and father and I first moved to Signal Hill in 1918, it was my father's dream to grow avocados on the hill, and to that end, he eventually acquired about 17 acres of arable land along the slopes of Signal Hill, and it was also his dream to have a sort of a botanical garden at our home place at 19th Street and Redondo Avenues. And to that end, the whole area there was planted in tropical plants, avocados, nectarines, sapotas, feijoas, natal plums, cherimoyas, hookerianas, a dozen different varieties of avocado trees, varieties of peach, grapes, everything else. It was a little paradise tucked away there. But all of this ended with the advent of the discovery of oil. After oil was discovered, which of course was a great blessing to our family, life on the hill became increasingly more difficult for us and for our small group of neighbors surrounding us. Gradually, one by one, most of the neighbors decamped. They took their oil money, their royalties, and either sold or moved their homes to other locations around the city of Long Beach. So along about 1928, some 7 years after oil was discovered, we found ourselves living again in virtual isolation on Signal Hill. There were no neighbors of my, that is, there were no friends of ours any longer there. The friends who were to become our neighbors after my father sold property to them had gone. Furthermore, our house was a wooden structure, and the incessant shaking of the earth caused by the drilling wells caused our house to shake 24 hours a day. And I can remember it was a commonplace thing to have my mother's pots and pans on our kitchen stove making a merry clatter every time she prepared a meal. They would just rattle away because the whole house shook. The house was not set on concrete foundations. It was set on what we called mud sills, which made it even more prone to vibration and shaking. It had been my father's idea that this would just be a temporary structure for us, and he would build a fine new home in the years to come. So we were more or less camping out, you might say, in our home, but my father never built the large home that he had promised for my mother, at least not there on Signal Hill. Well, it just got so noisy and so dirty with trucks roaring by day and night. My mother's laundry out on the line would be splattered with oil if a well came in or blew in close by. Across the street from us was a gas absorption plant and a gasoline refinery, and there was always dangers of fire. It soon became a miserable place to live, and what had been a veritable local Garden of Eden on Signal Hill now became a dirty, typical town lot oil field in which the comforts of living were sacrificed to the desire for oil. And in 1929, my father and mother finally decided that they had enough, and we moved lock, stock, and barrel to the flat building that my father had built in 1917 at the corner of Fifth Place and Ocean Boulevard, overlooking the ocean in downtown Long Beach. About 1922, that is the fall of 1922, when I was 12 years of age, I was sent to board at the military academy, which at that time was located on the Ocean Bluff, a short distance west of 39th Place. It was more or less at the foot of what might have been Euclid Avenue, except that the military academy was located on the south side of Ocean Boulevard, and Euclid Avenue ended on the north side. Right after World War I, military academies became very fashionable. There were a number of ex-officers of the U.S. Army, and some of these men started military academies. Others found employment in the military academy. This particular military academy was known as the Long Beach Military Academy and was run like an English school. It was operated, owned and operated by Professor and Mrs. Blackwell. I don't think I ever knew their first names. The old gentleman was simply called the Professor or Professor Blackwell, and Mrs. Blackwell was simply called Mrs. Blackwell. The Blackwells were English, and how they ever arrived in Long Beach, I was never to know. And as I've said, they operated the school on the principles of an English public school, which, of course, actually means private school. There were two or three bungalow-type buildings around on the school grounds, and those became our classrooms. And the curriculum, which we were taught, was very heavy on Latin, Greek, some mathematics, and a great deal of very tiring drilling. We had three or four instructors, all ex-U.S. Army officers. or at least that's what they were supposed to be, ex-officers, though I suspected in the case of one or two that they never got much beyond the rank of corporal in the U.S. Army. These ex-servicemen not only taught class, but drilled us out on the drill field. I was sent to this school primarily because my mother and father wanted a little relief from my constant presence. At that time, as I say, I was 12 years of age, an active and boisterous boy. My father was getting along in years. He was 61 years of age, and my mother was about 36. And they wanted a life of their own, at least for as much time as they could spend together, even though I did have a younger brother. I don't fault them for this. In retrospect, looking back on it, I can quite sympathize with their desire to get the oldest boy off somewhere where he'd be taken care of so they could devote more time to each other. But I will say that I hated that military academy with a passion. And every week or so when my parents would visit me, I would run crying to their car, begging them to take me away from that military school. It wasn't my idea of any fun or happiness. It was get up in the morning at 5:30 a.m., bathe in cold water, form out on the parade ground for the hoisting of the flag, marching into a breakfast that consisted of cold, congealed oatmeal, some thin milk, a couple of crackers, then to once again line up in formation and have an assembly. Then the ranks would disperse and we would go to our respective classrooms to agonize over Caesar's conquest of Gaul, which we had to read and translate from the original Latin. The boys sent to this school were pretty much of a cross-section of society, except that the percentage of the boys coming from broken homes was much larger than you would find in say, a public school. A lot of the boys sent there were boys that were incorrigible at home, as I suppose I was. There were children who were problem children, and there were also children sent there from wealthy families and families with some pretensions to education or breeding. I would say of the 80 or so boys enrolled in the military academy when I was going there in the early 1920s, about 30 of the boys came from broken homes and could be classified as problem children. Then there was about 20 or so you might call average students from average middle class homes, and the balance came from nice homes and nice parents. We had sons of Navy personnel, that is officers, and I made some very good friends there with the people that I was quite happy and proud to associate with in later life. But it was a hard, rigorous school. We always showered in cold water. Our meals were Spartan. Actually, we were pretty much circumscribed as to what we could do. I mentioned that we got up at 5:30 every morning. That was the exception to that was, of course, Sunday morning, when we had the luxury of sleeping in as late as 7 o'clock. And on Sunday morning, instead of the inevitable constant breakfast fare of congealed cold oatmeal porridge, we were allowed to have a shredded wheat biscuit. Meals were mainly English style, that is, boiled potatoes, tasteless fish, Desserts, when we had desserts, were English novelties such as treacle pudding, which was a glutinous mass of starch with some maple syrup worked into it or poured over it. We drank nothing but water. We were allowed one glass of water per meal. We were allowed no condiments, no salt, no pepper, nothing like that. At the head of a long table where I usually sat, I was one of the favored ones that got to sit at the long table with Professor and Mrs. Blackwell. There were other tables around the large mess hall where, as you went down in the ranks, boys were assigned to these tables. If you had committed some infraction, you ended up in outer Siberia, so to speak, because you were given a small table away from the beneficent rays of Professor and Mrs. Blackwell, who sat at the head, as I've said, of the big table. Professor and Mrs. Blackwell had their meals served to them on silver trays and silver dishes, and bore no resemblance at all to the kind of food which we peons had to eat. Occasionally, some of us were allowed a graciously offered helping of roast chicken or something of that nature if we had been particularly good during that week. But as I say, I hated every moment of my time at the military academy with a passion, and I was in seventh heaven when finally, after 3.5 years of the military academy rigors, I was allowed once again to go home and go to public school. Occasionally, the ex-servicemen who served as teachers and drill instructors at the Long Beach Military Academy, occasionally these men would leave and strike out on their own and start a military academy in competition with the Long Beach Military Academy. One such military academy, started by an ex-officer and ex-teacher at Long Beach Military Academy, became known as the Southern California Military Academy and was located on Cherry Avenue in the city of Signal Hill. This military academy apparently flourished because I can remember for years driving past its campus and seeing the cadets drilling and marching, and I imagine that it was fairly successful. The Long Beach Military Academy, there near 39th Place and Ocean Boulevard, lasted only until about, 1930 or so, when Professor Blackwell, who by that time was an old gentleman in his late 80s, died. And Mrs. Blackwell sold the buildings and moved, I believe, to Santa Monica. The main building of the old Long Beach Military Academy, that is the large three-story building, was sawn in half and transported to Alameda Heights, where it was put together and became the residence for a family there. And many, many years later, in the 1950s, after I had built a house on some property I purchased in Alameda Heights, I could look out of my dining room window and see that old green building where I had first lived when I had been exiled to the military academy and away from my beloved Signal Hill and my oil wells. With our present knowledge of geology, it would seem to anyone that Signal Hill was a very inviting target for the drilling of a wildcat well. There had been many, many structures similar to Signal Hill that had been successfully drilled. It was a natural anticline to trap oil. Yet, for some strange reason, early oil pioneers ignored the hill, and it wasn't until 1915 that there became some interest in drilling for oil on Signal Hill. And accordingly, early in 1917, an exploratory well was started in the vicinity of Wardlow Road and the present Long Beach Boulevard. This well was drilled by Union Oil Company and was called the Bixby No. 1. Union drilled out there on what we now know as the northwest flank because it was a commonly held theory that a structure such as Signal Hill, which had an elevation of 365 feet, would be so broken and so faulted and cracked that it would be next to impossible to produce oil right on top of the structure. It was felt that the only possible place to drill for oil in a structure deemed to be so broken and faulted as Signal Hill would be out on the flanks, where the faulting was presumed to be not so extensive. So consequently, Union Oil Company took a large lease out there on the northwest flank and drilled their Bixby No. 1. A dry hole resulted. Apparently, the Union geologist believed in the idea that the underground formations near the hill's main elevations were much too broken, and so they drilled where the ground was flatter, and they couldn't have made a worse mistake. This Wildcat well was drilled to a depth of 3,449 feet and abandoned when no oil showings had been encountered at that point. But Union Oil Company had unknowingly barely missed a major find in 1917. If they had drilled a well to the same depth, only a very short distance to the southeast, closer to the hill's main structure, that well would undoubtedly have discovered the tremendous accumulation of oil and gas which lay waiting beneath the surface for the shale oil company Alamitos No. 1 to find. It was an ironic thing, and a lot of fortunes were made and lost because of that error. After the Union well failed to be a producer, a great number of people who had optimistically bought property in and around the Union well and even up into the main elevation of the hill, these people became discouraged and sold their properties at very, very low prices. I can remember finding an old Long Beach Press newspaper which had been used to line a drawer of our house on Signal Hill. We moved, of course, to Signal Hill in 1918. So my mother had placed some newspapers in drawers, as was the custom at that time. And since we moved there just about a year after Union had abandoned its well, there were consequently some mention of this fact in these old newspapers. And I can recall there was an ad in the classified section of the press which advertised two lots for sale on Signal Hill for $600 a lot. These lots were being offered by Jonah Jones Sr., who was the father of Jonah Jones Jr., a prominent oil attorney in the city of Long Beach for many, many years. I had run across this clipping in 1929 when we left our old home place there on Signal Hill to move to my father's flat buildings at Fifth Place and Ocean Boulevard. And I had kept that clipping among my possessions. I recall about 1934, as a joke one time, I took the clipping to my friend Jonah Jones Jr., the oil attorney, handed it to him and said, Jonah, I have this advertisement here about those lots on Signal Hill that your father wanted to sell, and I'm willing to pay you $600 a piece for them. Well, Jonah laughed because Jonah Jones Sr., of course, had been unable to move the lots after the news had got out that the Union Well was a dry well, and he had to keep them. So about a year and a half later, Shell Oil Company was nosing around and was taking leases, and Shell leased Jonah Jones Sr.'s lots, drilled three wells on them, and those wells produced a fortune for the Jones family. A note by the narrator. I'm sorry I know nothing really about the E.J. Miley interest and the Updike well located on the east slope of Reservoir Hill. I was